Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. In this week's episode, Political Personality Clashes, I'm analysing one particular relationship which goes to the heart of our political life right now by looking at the leaders of the largest parties, Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer. Politics is less about policy and more about personalities, and in an ideal world, all politicians would put aside political differences to get on and deliver on ways to make the nation a better place. But what if politics is more about the playground, with psychological flaws or bullies, with fears and ambition? For Reaction, I'm Lucy Beresford, and for this episode of On the Couch, I am delighted to welcome Robert Hutton, author and freelance journalist. Hello, Rob.
Hi there.
Thanks for being my guest on the couch. Now, you have written very recently about the personalities of Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer and how different they are, which I guess is fine politically, but you've also really touched on how much they actually loathe each other. You wrote, the animosity between the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition is almost tangible. It may be the bitterest, most personal rivalry at the top of British politics to date, which I guess for those of us old enough to live through the Blair Brown psychodrama is saying something.
That was the one that worried me. comparison.
That was pretty brutal. But actually, can you give me a bit of context then? So where do you think it stands in relation to those other big fallings out of recent memory? Maybe not even just Blair and Brown, but, you know, Heath and Thatcher.
So Blair and Brown was deeply personal. And actually, if you look at the way that, I mean, Brown obviously never talks about it, never really wrote about it. You look at the way that Blair talked about it, he described their early relationship when both men come into Parliament in 1983, they're junior Labour MPs, the Labour Party is nowhere, and they're sharing a tiny, tiny office. In those days, office space in Parliament was at an incredible premium. So they don't even have staff. It's just the two of them sort of wedged into this space where I think if one of them needed to go out of the room, the other one had to move. We're talking about that cramped. And they spend all of their time there and discussing politics and discussing how politics should happen. And the Blair phrase is, it's something like that they were like lovers. They were so close to each other. They're so interested in getting back to talking to each other. So there's this incredibly intense, close relationship. And then they
physically
rise
intimate
up
as well.
Physically intimate in that room. Small space. And, you know, when you do work in close confinement with other people, it does become more than a working relationship. They both start to rise. And obviously, at some point, they get separate offices. And then the death of John Smith sort of creates this moment where they have to decide who is going to be the leader. And to be honest, I mean, you talk to most sort of political historians, most people who were there, it was clear by then that it was going to be Blair and not Brown. But Brown and the people around him hadn't realised that and didn't accept it. And so you had this betrayal, which was felt...
Well, it was felt like a betrayal,
it felt like a betrayal to Brown. Blair would say there was no deal, there was never a deal, there was no betrayal. You know, this is how politics works. And actually, we'll come back to the Blair and Brown sort of archetype for how politics works is interesting for Starmer and Johnson. But this is how politics works. You know, the opportunity is there. I am the best man. I am taking it. And Brown felt, no, this was mine. It felt like the older brother who had been overtaken by the younger brother, yeah. I think is quite an interesting way of thinking about it. You know, who you just got here. He is actually older. He was in 1983, he was by far the bigger figure in the Labour Party. And this sort of shiny whippersnapper has sort of come up the inside lane and has overtaken him. What's going on there? And so that was very personal, but at the same time, fundamentally, as a political rivalry, what they both wanted was for the Labour Party to win elections. And so there were moments when you would get them both pulling in the same direction. And again, everyone who's involved in the project says that it says that the sort of the weeks and months when Tony and Gordon were working in the same direction were amazing, because you suddenly, all of the sort of the great skills that both of these great politicians had, instead of being sort of directed at offense and defense against each other, were pushing out against against their actual political opponents. And so it was, that's a weird and different rivalry, I suppose, would be my argument. Whereas you are never going to see Keir Starmer buying Boris Johnson an ice cream, as we saw in this famous image in the 2005 election campaign of Blair and Brown. Their rivalry is both political, and this was the point. It feels like it's more than that. It's not just here's the leader. Of course, the leader of the Labour Party thinks that the leader of the Conservative Party shouldn't be Prime Minister. Of course.
But it's like all those good film trailers, isn't it? So, you know, this time it's personal.
I think it is.
Because you even see David Cameron getting on with Nick Clegg. You really did sense that they got on really well.
Could have
gone for a beer together. But your contention, which I'm sure is absolutely right, which is that, yes, Starmer and Johnson are political opponents and we would expect them to not get on over policy. But it is so personal. And psychologically, if you have a personality clash with someone, it's often because they are very triggering for you. Their very existence stirs up something for you from your past. So in what way do you think the respective pasts of Starmer and Johnson, their childhoods maybe, or their education, help explain this particular brutal personality clash?
So I think it's Oxford. It's the English class system, which is sort of endlessly fascinating. And let's look at who these two men are. Boris Johnson is not actually, although he sort of comes across as being very posh, he is not posh in the way that David Cameron is posh. David Cameron had actual kings in his lineage. And more than that, David Cameron had grown up in this incredibly stable home environment. His parents actually lived in an old rectory. His father's a stockbroker. As there so often is in the lives of prime ministers, there is a sort of childhood family trauma, which is his father is ill. I mean, I'm now trying to remember exactly what the condition that his father had was. And and obviously he lived for a long time, but his father has been in some way slightly disabled. And as a result, maybe there's a bit of the sense of got to get on with things. But actually, fundamentally, David Cameron's upbringing is very stable. Boris Johnson's upbringing, on the other hand, is completely chaotic. And there's all of the childhood trauma that you could want. His father is a philanderer. They are constantly moving around. His mother has a breakdown at some point, quite probably the result of Stanley's behaviour. They live in, somebody told me the other day, it's an astonishing number of homes before Boris Johnson is 18. And his mother is absent for a lot of that. And so Alexander, in fact, Johnson, at some point creates this character of Boris Johnson and seems to do it quite early. It's certainly he's doing it. He's done it by the time he's at Eton.
Which I've often wondered was actually a rebellion against the stability of Eton. There's something about stability that Boris Johnson finds very difficult because it's not what he's used to. So he has to create this alternative reality, even within the structure of the school.
And Eton is an incredibly nurturing environment. I mean, I'm not an old Etonian, but everything that you read about Eton suggests that whenever I read about it, I think all schools should be like this. there's a great teacher-pupil ratio. There's loads of resources. But more than that, there does seem to be a genuine sort of desire. We're going to sit down and think about each of these boys and what is the thing about this boy that we can bring out. That's why it doesn't just produce academically bright people. It's produced this sort of generation of leading British actors, because somebody has sat there and thought, do you know what, actually young Damian Lewis. This boy is never going to be a nuclear physicist, but he might do something with himself on stage if we give him a chance. And in that environment, what Alexander Johnson does is create Boris, who is this personality of a sort of caricature posh boy. And whether it's sort of constructed parts of Bertie Wooster, shades of every film about the English upper classes, every book, there's shades of Evelyn Waugh in there. There's all sorts of sort of.
But it's a very skewed performance, because it isn't a flash man portrayal. It's not the brutal side of it. It's very lovable rogue,
yes,
dimension, yes, as opposed to brutal bullyish. And that is also a conscious choice. To still love me, that need, yes, to be loved is still there.
And the other person who sort of creates a caricature posh boy character around themselves while at Eton is Jacob Rees-Mogg. Who also actually is in English class terms, Jacob Rees-Mogg, as I understand it, is not as posh, not in the way that the Camerons are posh. Again, not in the let's talk about your ancestors kind of way. Not in the we've been doing this for 500 years. And there are people in the Tory party who have literally point you to their great, all of their ancestors did something, whether it was at Waterloo or in Parliament in the 18th century or something. And neither Rees-Mogg nor Johnson are like this. They're very much sort of Johnny come lately, parvenu sort of type.
So why does that press such a button for Keir Starmer then?
Because Keir Starmer is, on the other hand, grows up the son of a toolmaker in South London, first in his family to go to university. On the left, comes from a left-wing family. There again, there's trauma there. His mother was sick for a lot of his childhood. That's sort of the dominating thing of the Starmer childhood. And I think someone like Starmer, someone like Gordon Brown, looks at the world and says, if I work hard enough, if I try hard enough, if I study, I do the reading, if I work harder than everyone else, I will make it. I will get there. Lyndon Johnson in America is the same. His method was, you've got to do more. You've got to do more than anyone else will do. You've just got to work harder. And all of them encounter then, and Lyndon Johnson encountered JFK, some smoothie shops lad with lots of money and all the posh schools, who just sort of wanders up and says, this looks like a bit of a laugh, not going to take it too seriously. Yeah. I'm good on camera. That was JFK. Or JFK, you know, Lyndon Johnson can't take JFK seriously because Lyndon Johnson's running the US Senate and he never sees JFK, who is supposed to be a senator, because JFK is off on TV the whole time. And then suddenly JFK becomes the Democratic Party's candidate in 1960. And Johnson can't understand what's happened. How have I, who has worked so hard, who has made all the connections, been overtaken by this slick kid? Gordon Brown, exactly the same. Starmer and Johnson, it's not exactly the same, because obviously Johnson was in politics well before Starmer was. But this sense of, how dare you, unserious person? There's a line from Max Hastings that Boris Johnson is the hardest working lazy person he knows, or the laziest hardworking person he knows. It's not that he doesn't do any work, but he affects not to do any work. And the whole chaotic, what am I doing? The turning up and pretending not to have a speech, which is a complete shtick. You know,
Jeremy Vine talking about
watching him watching this happen again and again, but it's hugely entertaining and he carries it off very well.
But that's also all about charm, isn't it? I had a headmaster who said to a friend of mine, you know, charm will only get you so far. To which my friend said, no, it will take me all the way. That actually, charm really smooths the wheels, opens the doors, whatever. And for, as you say, for people who make a very clear belief in their life, which is that effort in, reward out, if I work really hard, then I'll get the rewards, that must just feel so devastating, that your belief system no longer works. It doesn't have the same currency in the outside world as it does in your sort of small world of education.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it does work in education. And actually, of course, Tamra is enormously successful in education. He goes to Leeds, then he goes and does his... He's at Oxford at the same time as Johnson. And in his own way, he's very successful. He's off in the Labour Club, where he is a bit of a star in late 80s Oxford Labour Club. He's partly because he's a couple of years older, partly because the Oxford Labour Club in the 80s, Keir Starmer is authentically working class, and not everyone in the Oxford in the Oxford Labour Club in the 1980s can really claim that. You know, I mean, a couple of years later, the Miliband brothers will be there with the best will in the world. You know, people like them, people like Ed Balls and so on, these are the sons of academics. And whereas Keir Starmer, you know, can sort of, well, what does your dad do? He makes tools. Right, okay, that sounds pretty, you know. And also Keir Starmer is a bit of a charmer in this context. They are in a completely different world from the Oxford Union, which is sort of this dressing up. I can't remember which tie it is, whether it's white tie or black tie they have to wear, but they
it's much more Brideshead Revisited style, yes, of operating.
It's not taking politics seriously. The whole thing about the Oxford Union is you show up and are you going to be debating, you know, slavery is good or slavery is bad? Look, we're short one on slavery is good. Could you swap over to the other side? Of course I can. You know, so the Labour Club, that's unserious. That's not, politics is not about, you know, can I make an argument? Can I argue that black is white? Politics is about, we must get to the truth and solve these problems. And there's mutual contempt. If you're in the Labour Club, you look at these people and you go, this is a bunch of sort of frivolous poshos, you know, who are just fundamentally unserious. If you're in the Oxford Union, you look at the Labour Club and you say, these are a bunch of, I mean, dungareed bores. You know, they're just always wanging on about poverty or apartheid.
And do you think that contempt is distilled actually in what we're seeing between Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer today?
Completely.
Both ways, though. I mean, we can sense it from every question that Starmer asks at PMQs. But does it go the other way?
I'd be interested to know to what extent Boris Johnson would have been aware of Keir Starmer's existence in 1980s Oxford. It's entirely possible that he dismissed the whole lot as, oh, well, you know, a bunch of worthies, dull worthies, you know, that he doesn't need to take seriously. Obviously, he does have to take Keir Starmer seriously, in the sense that he is the leader of the opposition. With Johnson, it's almost a frustration. Why am I having to listen to your tedious nonsense?
Here's the thing. Certainly psychologically, the couple creates the couple. When you know, if you're in a marriage or if a new long-term relationship, the two of you have created that with all of the baggage that you bring to your relationship. So in a way, how important to both Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer is it that the other exists? Supposing it in that last election for the leadership, it hadn't been Boris Johnson, but it was Jeremy Hunt. Well, we'd obviously have different issues, but at the moment, it almost seems like they need each other to be the other's foil.
I think so. I think that's definitely true. I found myself thinking about this when I was researching a piece. You can easily imagine in a different life, Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer at the same dinner party. Boris Johnson's married to a QC, Keir Starmer is a QC, although Boris Johnson keeps going on about Starmer being an Islington lawyer. Boris Johnson actually was the one who lived in Islington, but they moved in very similar circles. They could easily have been neighbours, they could easily have been in the party, and there are no circumstances that I can imagine in which they would not have found themselves at opposite ends of the table sneering at each other. Just never have been friends, even if, you know, Johnson had stayed in journalism and Starmer had stayed sort of in private law practice. These two people are just always going to have this kind of antagonistic relationship. Keir Starmer and Jeremy Hunt, you can imagine getting on quite well, actually. You can imagine them getting on quite well in Parliament. You can certainly imagine them getting on quite well. They are both people who sort of have a kind of belief in seriousness. I think the Boris Johnson can't stand people who take things too seriously. For him, it's the great sin is just, all these boring people who are just wanting to make everything so dull and can't see the funny side. And Starmer, on the other hand, in this sort of, in the tradition of the left, sitting there going, no, but this stuff is serious, this stuff matters, and is frustrated with anyone who doesn't see why politics is an immensely serious business. It's the stuff of people's lives. It's whether someone has a home or not. It's whether their children go to a good school. It's whether they get treated in hospital. It's as though Starmer, you know, looks at his father going to sit with his mother in hospital and takes from that, it is tremendously important that there should be really good hospitals, a reasonable thing. Johnson looks at his mother having a breakdown as his father does whatever it is that he does, and sort of takes from that, I must not take any of this seriously.
Yeah, I mustn't get too attached.
And all this will pass. She will come back and we will be able to move forward.
Everything he does is about that, that sense of let's not get too attached to these things, because there will always be another day. There will always be a different game to play.
I mean, in one way, it's, you know, we try and teach our children resilience. It's a good thing not to get dragged down by your problems.
And does this matter, do you think, then, given that in a way they ought to understand each other quite well? They've both had their mothers' experiences have shaped them. Does it matter then that they don't get on? Does it matter to the nation? Because you said earlier that when Blair and Brown were getting on, obviously they were in the same government together, but that was fantastic. And when they didn't get on, it felt as if the feud was paralysing government at times. So again, does it matter that these two people don't get on, or are we just going to spend too much time in their psychodrama rather than things actually moving?
That's a really interesting question. I was talking to a Labour MP yesterday who's been in Parliament quite a long time, who was saying that one of the things they'd noticed had changed in this government was in the 1980s, they said, you know, you had a Conservative government that was doing lots of things that Labour MPs didn't like, obviously, but you could go to a minister and you could say, this thing that you're planning to do, I think unintentionally, you are going to do something that is really bad in my constituency. And as opposed to say, some of the things that they were going to do were intentional. They were going to close the pits, that they wanted to move Britain away from coal mining. You know, that was the plan. Some of the stuff was, often in government, you do things, you don't realise that this thing that works quite well in Surrey is not going to work quite so well in Sunderland, you know, and you could go to them and they wouldn't say, oh my goodness, you're right, let's fix it. But you would find that the problem sort of sometimes did get fixed. And so even in opposition, you could help your constituents by making sure that the sort of bits of government worked for their benefit. And they said, that's gone now. You can't, they're not interested in that. That doesn't work. And things happen behind the scenes to a surprising extent in politics. There's what's called Privy Council terms, where if your name is the Right Honourable, as in the Right Honourable Keir Starmer, you have sworn an oath, a separate oath to the Queen, and joined the Privy Council. And you can be invited in to Number 10 for what's called a briefing on Privy Council terms, where they will say to you, right, this is what we're doing with these troops. We're about to send the SAS here, or this is what's happening in Ukraine. We're about to supply this. We're telling you this because you ought to know it, but you're not allowed to go out and tell everyone else. Mm-hmm. And that's the oath. And that works. And actually that enables a functioning of government that I think often people don't appreciate. But that does require a level of trust on both sides, because fundamentally you are telling people secrets, and even if it's on Privy Council terms, it requires a level of trust and a level of respect. Is it a problem that isn't there? I think it is, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think it'll be quite hard to spot the areas where it's created a problem.
Well, finally, what about the electorate in all of this? Because there is a... there is a theory that often does the rounds, which is that we, as a nation, tend to elect one type of personality followed by the complete opposite, and everyone points...
This is the jock nerd principle, we call
exactly,
it.
Exactly, the sort of Thatcher followed by Major, followed by charmer performer Blair, followed by doer Gordon Brown, followed by charmer Cameron, followed by run through the fields of wheat May, and now Boris. Is it that simple? And should that give Starmer some hope?
But it depends. If they get if they replace Boris Johnson with Jeremy Hunt, it's a terrible problem. It's astonishingly resilient, the jock nerd theory, as you've just shown. And I think that the best hope for Starmer is that in two respects, A, that the Conservatives decide to hang on to Boris Johnson and that he has become an electoral liability where once he was an electoral asset. Boris Johnson, I mean, actually, was Boris Johnson an electoral asset in 2019? I think most Tories would say, oh my goodness, he was. Look at all these seats he won. If you look at the studies that are coming out of the election, the sort of the magisterial Palgrave British general election of 2019 suggests that actually, if you track Boris Johnson's popularity and in 2019 and compare it with Theresa May's popularity in 2017, there is never a point in which Johnson is as popular with the public as Theresa May was at every point in that campaign. What changed between Theresa May, and actually both of them were adopting the same broad electoral strategy, which is try and pick up all of these seats in the north. The Red Wall strategy was not new in 2017. It was explicitly the strategy in 2017. What made the difference was the collapse in popularity of Jeremy Corbyn. And Jeremy Corbyn in 2017 actually sort of people looked at him and thought, oh, he seems quite nice. You know, I've heard he's a monster, but, you know, and I've heard he's unkempt, but actually he's sort of here and his beard's trimmed and his suit fits and what he's saying seems relatively reasonable. That combined with Tory campaign errors was just enough to mean that Labour narrowly held a whole load of seats that would then fall.
And also perhaps a cohort of people who just, even if they weren't Brexiteers themselves, were just like, could we just get this done? Oh, you look like the person who is going to get that done.
So yeah, Brexit done was a terrific promise. And by 2019, Jeremy Corbyn if you look at the polling, Jeremy Corbyn is just massively unpopular and saying, look, it's me or it's him, was a great, what's called a squeeze message. So the Starmer hope essentially is that in probably 2023, that the public has accepted that he is not Corbyn and that Boris Johnson is awful and unpleasant, and he's not awful and unpleasant, and so they ought to switch to him. Will that work? I don't know.
Well, I'll get you back on nearer to the time of that election, and we can debate that at length. But in the meantime, Rob Hutton, thank you very much indeed for being such a wonderful guest on The Couch.